You rely on this podcast to stay informed and connected with your local community, and we rely on you. Without listener support, this show simply wouldn't exist. Be a part of the team that makes this show possible by donating to our home, KUOW. It only takes a minute. Donate at KUOW.org or follow the link in the show notes. And thank you.
You're listening to Soundside. I'm Diana Alpong in for Libby Denkman. For this story, we're going to zoom out a bit, like way, way out, to the sixth planet from our sun. Saturn has a ring system that has fascinated astronomers for centuries. The planet also has the largest collection of moons in the entire solar system, with 146. Those moons vary from small, heavily cratered rocky worlds to giant icy masses with underground oceans. Titan is the largest of Saturn's moons, and it's bigger than the planet Mercury. But it's the small moon, Enceladus, that is at the center of newly energized interest in the search for life outside of Earth. Here to talk to us about the latest quest on Enceladus is University of Washington postdoctoral scholar in Earth and Space Sciences, Fabian Klenner. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So, Fabian, first off, can you give us sort of like a real estate listing of Enceladus? What is it like?
Enceladus is one of these mid-sized icy moons of Saturn. It's only 504 kilometers in diameter. It basically is covered by an icy crust. And under this ice crust, you have a global liquid water ocean. And that makes it so interesting for the search for life.
How do we know that underneath this layer of ice, there is literally moving, is it moving water or is it all frozen water?
No, it's basically, it's liquid water. So we know that from the Cassini space mission. So NASA sent Cassini to the Saturn system, and the mission was launched in 1997 to investigate a planet and its moons and rings. And nobody expected Enceladus to be that interesting when Cassini was launched, but then the mission, the spacecraft arrived in the Saturn system and did some measurements, and then it figured out, hey, well, we can only explain this with liquid water, with a global liquid water ocean on this tiny moon. And that makes it so interesting for the search for life, because if you look at Earth, everywhere where is water, there's life. So whenever we find liquid water beyond Earth, they are very curious to look for life there.
Yeah, and that's what makes this such an intriguing subject of study right now, is that possibility. Last year, you were part of a team of scientists who discovered a compound that's key to enabling life on this particular moon. What did you find, and why was it so important?
So last year, we found phosphates. And this is so important because usually there are a few elements that are very important for life as we know it, and that's hydrogen, carbon, phosphorus, sulfur, oxygen, and nitrogen. And phosphorus is by far the least abundant in the universe, so just finding that in an ocean world is incredibly exciting. And the second thing is that phosphates, usually they like to be in the solid form in a rocky material. But here we found it in the liquid water ocean. So it is, in theory, available for bacterial cells or for life, if life is there.
When did you start working on your current project? And how big did it feel to find this discovery?
I actually joined the research team maybe 10 years ago or so, when I still was a student. And then I got involved into the Cassini mission, and I did plenty of lab experiments that supported the Cassini team. And the particular phosphate study was conducted 2-3 years ago. So that should be the time frame.
Nice. And when you made this discovery, how did it feel?
It was incredibly exciting. So my particular part here was conducting lab experiments. And it was like I went to the lab, I measured phosphates with our lab experiment. And when I saw the data, I was really like, wow, that's exactly what we see in space.
You're working with data from ice grains that NASA's Cassini spacecraft gathered as it flew around Saturn and its moons for more than a decade. How exactly does that work? And how long does it take for that data to return to Earth after being collected by the satellite? Like, this feels just otherworldly.
Yes. So I was working with data from Cassini, and so we are talking about something that is in the Saturn system, and transmitting data from the distance of Saturn back to Earth takes a bit less than 1.5 hours or so, just with the speed of light. So it worked in a way that the Cassini spacecraft had several instruments, and one of these instruments was designed to analyze ice grains that were actively emitted from Enceladus. And it worked in a way that these individual ice grains were hitting this instrument, generating so-called mass spectra, and that was the data that was sent back to Earth then.
Okay, this is a lot. There's a lot to consider and a lot of particles and pieces to keep track of. Last month, you published some new research related to the search for life on Enceladus, and that had to do with checking to see if our instruments could even detect the signature for biological life at all. This is really complicated stuff. It's even complicated for someone who knows about it. But can you give us, maybe in layman's terms, what you were specifically looking for?
Yes. So we know that this single ice grain analysis that was done by Cassini and that will be done by a mission that goes to another moon of Jupiter, to Europa, this is incredibly exciting and is extremely capable to get information of the composition of these grains and with that information of the underlying ocean on Enceladus. So, but nobody has ever detected life beyond Earth. And because we found so many interesting things by analyzing ice grains, for example, the phosphates that we were talking about, or also we know from these ice grains that the liquid water very likely interacts with a hot rocky core on Enceladus. And also the water is salty. And there are many, many spectacular findings that were made by ice grain analysis. So for me, the next question would be, can we actually use these instruments to go a step further to really find life? And then we conducted experiments in the laboratory and we were simulating the conditions in space and generating data that we can compare with data from space.
Okay. Again, there's a lot that goes into this. So you're saying ice grains. Would that be the equivalent of, like, I don't know, like frost or a snowflake? Like what is the earth equivalent to an ice grain?
Yeah, you can think of it like maybe a snowflake or something like that.
Okay.
Although snowflakes are a bit bigger,
So ice grains, we're talking tiny frozen particles.
they are tiny, tiny. They are in the micrometer size range, so they're really, really tiny.
Got it. And what's the result? Like, could we detect life out on another planet with our existing dust analyzing instruments? Did you determine that?
Yes, so that's actually the bottom line of our study. So we found that with current and future instrumentation, employing this technique, mass spectrometry analysis of individual ice grains, we are capable of finding bacterial cells, providing that these cells really care about getting incorporated into these ice grains, emitted into space, and then encountered by these instruments.
Right. So a lot of things have to go right for us to be able to make this detection.
Yes.
So to be clear, NASA's Cassini didn't have the capability to detect life, right? Because that was back in 1997. So that's left to future missions. So speaking of, are there any more missions planned to go back to Enceladus?
So right now there's no mission that is selected to go to Enceladus, but NASA announced 2 years ago that a mission to Enceladus has the second highest priority when they will pick their next big mission. So the highest priority has a Uranus mission. And also the European Space Agency just announced 3 weeks ago that their next big mission will go to Enceladus.
Wow, that's exciting. Cassini launched in 1997 and first arrived at Enceladus in 2005. It took a while to get there. Its final flyby of the moon was back in 2015, and you're working on data now. What are you hoping to find as you continue your search with that data?
That's a good question. So, I don't really know what to expect there. This was the same when we were finding the phosphates. So we were basically looking at a data set that we did not have a look at before that. And then we just looked at it and we found some strange signals that we couldn't really explain. And then I went to the lab and we found that phosphates are a pretty good match with the data from space. So there is still a lot of data to analyze, and maybe we find some other very interesting compounds. So it's hard to tell in advance what to look for.
Yeah, there's still a lot to not just look at and explore, but to discover truly as you're going through the data. Okay, so far we're talking about finding chemical compounds that could support life. It's all about potential because, you know, you're doing a lot of this sort of lab simulations, looking at data. But how likely is it that there could be actual life in the oceans below the frozen crust of this moon?
That's the $100 million question. We don't know if there is life, but what we know is that there are the right ingredients. So again, if we look at life on Earth, then life needed to originate, it needed liquid water, it needed organic compounds, it needed plenty of energy, and all these things appear to be present on Enceladus, plus our finding of phosphates and other life-supporting things like this water-rock interactions. So Enceladus really appears to be an incredibly good place to look for life. And that's why the space agencies also want to send more missions there and really look if there is life or not.
Okay, we're going to speculate a little bit. Use your scientific imagination, I guess. And I also just want to know, for you as a scholar, as someone who is passionate about this work, what does it mean if there is life there?
So if there's really life, then it would very likely have evolved completely independent of life on Earth. So, and then we basically have two different origins of life in the same solar system, basically in the same neighborhood. And this would certainly change our view on about the likelihood of life in the universe, because if you have two origins of life in the same neighborhood, you may have plenty of those in the universe.
Ah, got it. So it would help to confirm for us there's a good chance this is elsewhere also. Okay, that's very cool. What are the next steps that you're taking to keep chasing life in the solar system? You've got this first discovery. What are the next couple of months going to look like for you?
So for me here at the University of Washington, I am now very interested in how these ice grains actually form. Because as we discussed earlier, if really bacterial cells are incorporated into ice grains emitted into space and detected, they can be identified. So, but what we don't really know is if these bacterial cells actually care about getting incorporated into these individual ice grains. And I want to better understand this. So the ice grain formation and the ice grains path to the surface and to space. That's what I'm working on right now.
Ooh, big, tall order, but also very exciting to think about that whole process. Last question for you, Fabian. What about any other locations in our solar system are scientists looking at? And how does Enceladus compare to other moons or planets and their life-supporting potential?
So there's another icy moon around Jupiter that is named Europa. And NASA will send a spacecraft there. Launch is scheduled for October this year, actually. So
wow.
There will be an instrument that is designed for single ice grain analysis. So Europa also appears to have a global liquid water ocean. It has organic chemistry. It has plenty of energy. So there are also very good ingredients there. But we don't know a lot about this moon because no space mission was dedicated to investigate this moon until now. And NASA will change this by launching their mission in October. So yeah, and then of course there are other places in the solar system where scientists are interested to look for life. For example, Mars is a good example. So we are sending spacecraft very often there.
Yeah, Mars is the one we hear about the most. So it's exciting to hear about all the other possibilities for data collection and just understanding the universe even more. Fabian Klenner is a postdoctoral scholar in Earth and Space Sciences at the University of Washington. Fabian, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was really nice talking to you.
Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.
Seattle in the 90s. A tidal wave of iconic music roars out of this sleepy city and launches a pop culture revolution. Here's a story you haven't heard. Let the Kids Dance is a new podcast about the rise and fall of Seattle's teen dance ordinance, the law that made it illegal for young people to go to concerts. A story of moral panic, grassroots activism, and an unstoppable music community that fought for its freedom. Listen to Let the Kids Dance from KUOW and the NPR Network.